This week on Making Contact.
And I remember as a kid, there was a sort of a nursery rhyme that was Ching Chong Chinaman sitting on a fence trying to make a dollar out of 15 cents. But here we are, and we're still trying to make a dollar out of 15 cents.
Income generation is one indicator of power differences between racial groups in the U.S. In 1968, African Americans made 55 cents for every dollar a white person made. In 2004, it was 58 cents. But accumulated wealth, not income alone, may be the most revealing index of inequality. So why the disparities? Author and organizer Meiju Louie has some answers. I'm Tina Rubio, your host on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Meiju Louie is from a family of Chinese immigrants. She was a kitchen worker for 20 years. Eventually, she rose through the labor ranks to become president of her local union. Now she's executive director of United for a Fair Economy, a nonpartisan group that raises awareness about the downside of concentrated wealth and power in the U.S. She recently co-authored the book, The Color of Wealth, The Story Behind the U.S. Racial Wealth Divide. She spoke in San Francisco at Cody's Books in June 2006.
How many of you have heard of string theory? Okay. I am not a physicist at all, but the idea is that there are parallel universes. Somehow there's these little strings that make up the whole universe, and the way that they're put together, there could be actually many universes all right now in the same space. And when I heard that theory, I was like, okay, yep, people of color have known that for a long time, that there are many worlds going on right here. And in fact, when the Chinese first came to this country, they called white people ghosts. And it wasn't because of the color, because ghosts don't necessarily have to be white. That's a white invention, probably. But because they lived in another very incomprehensible world, a world in which the same rules did not apply. So that continued for a very long time. For example, my father, the rules of gravity seemed to apply to him. He got a job, and he stayed where he was for a very long time. His feet were stuck to the ground. But for white people, it seemed like the rules of gravity did not apply, because these younger guys would come in, they'd pop to the top right over him. So, that kind of made me wonder, but for my dad and for most immigrants, a common mantra, and I think in the African American community you hear it too, you have to work twice as hard to be equal. That was what my father said to me. But I think for the second generation, it's like, no. We're here, we're citizens, we're this equal to everybody, and we want to have exactly the same thing. So the story that we hear all the time is a story that is told from the point of view of the dominant group. It's the story that's the most vivid. It's the story that's told early and often. So we always hear the European American story, but we really don't hear the others. So that's part of the purpose of The Color of Wealth. We wanted to lift up those other stories that have been invisible, those stories that are ghost stories to mainstream America. And I don't know if any of you are photographers, but there's a thing called depth of field where you make the foreground really clear and the background fuzzy. Well, we people of color have been in the fuzzy background, and this book is trying to pull it forward so that we can really see very clearly all the different layers of American history. And I'll just give you one example. The Civil War. I know when I went to school, I was taught that the Civil War was kind of like an anti-racist war. It was to free the slaves, and there were these really good northern folks who were like ready to give their lives to free the slaves. But, you know, if you look more carefully at what else was going on at that particular point in time, the Europeans who were in charge had just finished really, through violence, moving native peoples off of their land. So starting in 1830, the Indian Removal Act moved native tribes off of land in the southeast to west of the Mississippi. But as time went on and more European immigrants came, there was a bigger and bigger demand for land, so that they also wanted to have control of the land west of the Mississippi. And there were two theories of how that land should be used. One was the Southern theory, that land should be big chunks and it should be made into plantations. And then there was the more Northern theory, that those pieces of land should be chopped up into little bits and have individual families to homestead them. Well, the North won, and in 1862, the Homestead Acts were passed, which gave away that land that had been native land to European Americans. So this was one of the biggest transfers of wealth, and actually the foundation of all wealth in the United States is the ownership of land, and it was taken from one group and given to another. Now, for Asians, you know, how did the Civil War affect us? People don't even talk about Asians or natives at that time. I mean, people just look at it as a black and white question. There were numbers of Asians here at that time in history, too. But anti-Asian sentiment was building, too. So the ending, the Civil War didn't really affect Asians much at all, except that the 14th Amendment said that if you were born in this country, you were automatically a citizen. And that was the first time that was true. Before that, Chinese and other Asians were not able to be citizens, whether they were born here or came from somewhere else or not. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But in terms of the Civil War being a war against racism, it simply was not true. Many of the states that were formed after the Civil War not only banned slavery, they banned free blacks from being there and having any land. So that kind of puts that story in a different context. So we wrote this book partly to answer a contemporary question as well. And that question is, how is it that in 2006, 2.25 centuries since the U.S. was founded on the principle that all men are created equal, 150 years after enslaved peoples were freed, and 40 years after the Civil Rights Movement, why is it that there is still an economic gap between white families and families of color? And just to give you a couple of quick numbers, and there's a lot of data in the book, that in terms of income, in 1968, the year of Martin Luther King's death, an African American person made 55 cents on the white person's dollar. In 2004, we took a look at it, and it had moved up 3 cents. It was now 58 cents on the white person's dollar, which meant that at that rate of progress, it would take 362 more years to reach parity. So some of us know Brown versus Board of Education said we have to move toward equality at all deliberate speed, but 362 more years seems a little bit too slow. But you know, it's even more shocking if we look at wealth. And what we mean by wealth is assets that are above and beyond income. So I mentioned the number 58 cents in terms of income, but in terms of wealth, people of color only have about 15 cents on the white person's dollar in terms of the assets. So that is just an enormous gap. And I remember as a kid, there was a sort of a nursery rhyme that was Ching Chong Chinaman sitting on a fence trying to make a dollar out of 15 cents. I don't know if any of you remember this, but I remember kind of wondering, well, because kids would say it to me as if it was funny and I would kind of laugh because I didn't get it. So what was this person trying to make a dollar out of 15 cents? I couldn't figure that out. But here we are in 2006. I mean, that saying actually came from a much earlier period of history when the Chinese were excluded from a lot of kinds of work and asset building activities. But here we are in 2006 and we're still trying to make a dollar out of 15 cents. So we know that wealth is very important, and of course most of the people in our country today want to have wealth. But how do you get wealthy?
Pull yourself up and you're in bootstraps.
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and sometimes they say, you know, for women, we got to pull ourselves by our bra straps. We don't even, you know, we don't even have boots, so it's even harder for us. So that's absolutely true. A number of the things that you've said too, in terms of savings. But if you don't have enough income, if you need to use all your income to get by, you're not going to be able to save. So there's that inheritance. You know, yeah, it'd be great to inherit, but for that you have to win the game of ovarian roulette and be born to the right parent, which unfortunately we don't have a choice of who our parents are. So certainly, though, hard work is the main myth that we have. That's been with us ever since the United States began. So John Paul Getty was one of the first millionaires around the turn of the century in the early 1900s, and at that time $1 million was a huge amount of money. It's still is, but it doesn't seem as much since we have so many billionaires now, 374 of them. But everybody wanted to know John Paul Getty's secret. And he said, it's not that hard. I'll give you my three little secrets. He said, number one, work hard. How many here can work hard? Okay. Rise early. Find an oil well. So the one thing about John Paul Getty is he did understand that luck plays a role in getting wealth too, which you didn't mention, but luck is a part of the story. But one thing he didn't say, and it is a hidden piece of the wealth story, where did he get that land? Where did he get that land? So he got the land probably from his daddy or his granddaddy, but about a fourth of the people in the United States today that are citizens and that are white can trace the beginnings of their asset building from the Homestead Act and being given 160 acres of free land. So, you know, not everybody was as lucky as John Paul Getty because there wasn't oil under every single piece of land, but the land itself was actually a gift from the government. And one of the myths we hear today is that it's people of color that are using all of the benefits, that all your tax dollars are going to benefit poor people. But if we look throughout U.S. history, and actually still today, the biggest subsidies are going to white families and going to those who are already wealthy. So it wasn't even just the families that were homesteading, but it was the big railroad companies that got the largest chunks of land. So what we try to do in The Color of Wealth is to uncover the government policies that led to the wealth creation and lead to the disparity that we have today, because we feel like if you don't have this information, it's hard to counter the argument that, well, gee, if people of color, now that we have equal employment laws and affirmative action, why aren't they just doing just dandy like white families are? So maybe because this book was written by five women, we didn't just start with data. We started with our own stories and wondered, like, why is it that our families are in the situation that they're in today? So I just wanted to run through really quickly sort of the main thread of the four different stories, the four different racialized groups. And the stories have one thing in common, which is that the government and that the majority of the people felt that the United States was really a country for people of European descent. That was, and that other people were not really as qualified to become U.S. citizens and to be equal participants. However, the rationale and the mechanisms for creating the disparities were different in each group. So I already mentioned with the Native American people, it was really the theft of the land. And most of us know the African American story, that not only were African Americans not allowed to acquire wealth, not allowed to see the fruit of their labor accrue to themselves and their families, but they were property themselves. So you could see this in the theories of the slave trade. The British felt that it was better to get as many slaves as possible on one ship, pack them in really tight, and if a few sort of rotted along the way, just throw them out, but you still have more at the end. Whereas the French had a different theory. They said pack them in more loosely so that more would survive at the end of the trip, but they were really, it was like talking about tomatoes or bananas. So if you looked on the ledgers of plantations owners, you would see, you know, X number of mules, X number of plows, X number of slaves. So slaves showed up on the ledgers. They were someone else's wealth. And it's been estimated that the value of slaves in 1860 was about $3 billion just in holding of the slaves. And it also has been estimated that if they had been paid wages, that would have been equaled about $1.4 trillion. So if you think that if there were to be a $1.4 trillion circulating in the African American community today, the fruits of that labor, and that's just wages, that's not even ownership, we would have a very different picture, an economic picture in the United States today.
That's Meiju Louie, co-author of The Color of Wealth. When we come back, she'll talk about two other groups, Latinos and Asians. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. Meiju Louie continues her presentation by discussing the history of immigrant labor, the construction of color, and some hopeful initiatives toward economic justice.
For Latinos, it really had to do with global economic concerns. We think of globalization as something new, but it really isn't. At the time that the United States was founded, the biggest other power was Spain. And what the United States said in the Monroe Doctrine is that all the countries south of the border were the United States' backyard, and we would protect them from Spain. Of course, we know that it was also to protect them for our own use, so the labor we used over many years, and as well as their natural resources. It's kind of like the people south of the border were living in the servant quarters. You know, whenever we've needed them, we would call them in to do some work in the big house, but we would just send them back to the backyard and never let them move in. So we see that going on today with the whole issue around the undocumented workers. It's nothing new. There was a bracero program in World War II where Mexican laborers were imported and then sent back again when we didn't need them. It was actually done to the Chinese as well in terms of building the railroad. You know, when they were needed to build the railroad, you were welcome to do that hard work for a little pay, but when you were through, you were not allowed to have your hard work, you know, buy you the benefits of citizenship. So just really quickly, my own story in terms of the Asian story, that story is more about maintaining Asians as perpetual foreigners. So no matter how many generations we're here, we're always considered not quite real Americans. So it's a very much of a nativist argument as opposed to a purely racist argument. So in my family, there were four generations of men who spent a significant amount of time in the United States, but they were never citizens, and they never were allowed to have family life. And I remember growing up hearing about this, and it never occurred to me to ask my dad, like, well, where was your mom? Where was your sisters? What was up with that? Of course, my father also had the misfortune of having four daughters, so he had no clue. We could run circles around him, so it did benefit us, I have to say. But it took me much longer to learn this, because again, it wasn't a history I learned in school, but there were specific laws excluding women in 1870, and then in 1882, the Chinese became the first group to be excluded. Now, I just wanted to mention the citizenship issue. In 1790, one of the very first acts of Congress was to pass the naturalization law, and it said that you had to be in this country for 2 years, you had to be of upstanding character, you had to say that you were loyal to the Constitution, and you had to be white. And that was the first time that word kind of crept into the legal language, and maybe the language in general of the United States, or probably any country. But people really didn't know what color they were. So when the Chinese came here, they didn't say, well, gee, I don't think I'm white. They didn't really know what color they were. And you could say the same for Germans or French or Swiss or Irish. They didn't know what color they were either. They thought of themselves as French or German or Irish or Chinese or, you know, so color was really a foreign concept to everyone. But for the Chinese, they thought, well, I can do those first three things, so I probably can do the latter two. So I'm gonna sue for the right to be white. And they took their cases to court. The Chinese were the first, and they were considered not to be white because there was a theory that native peoples had descended from Asians who had crossed the isthmus like tens of thousands of years ago. I think that theory's been disproved. But anyway, therefore, Chinese were really native people, and native people had no rights. They could not become citizens. They couldn't testify against white people. This particular case had to do with a Chinese man that was murdered by a white man, and the white man was convicted on the basis of evidence from three Chinese. But when they sued, they appealed the case, it was thrown out, and the white guy was freed because the Chinese men could not testify against them. So this protection of rights, even the protection of life, was something that was not afforded those who did not have the right of citizenship. So against all odds, every one of these communities built wealth. So in the case of African Americans, there were communities that were all African American that were quite wealthy. The African-American author here, Rose Brewer, is from Tulsa. And of course, the history in Tulsa was that there was a thriving African-American community with their own banks and their own sort of Black Wall Street. But the white community was actually much more jealous of successful African-Americans. They burned that part of town down, drove the African-Americans out of town, and there's never been any compensation. In fact, there was a reparation suit specifically to Tulsa, which was just lost, actually, in this past year. But of course, we know the story of the Japanese as well. Again, in ethnic enclaves, they were able to build businesses and wealth that served, you know, the Japanese community. So it was money circulating within the Japanese community. But they were very successful. And then in 1942, and this is where the foreign thing comes in, that they were considered as potentially traitors and disloyal to the country and put into internment camps. They only had 1 week to dispose of their property. So obviously, their homes and businesses went at fire sale prices. And they never recouped that loss and had to start all over again. So if you take a look at this history, we see that at every period of history, there have been boosts given to white families. And I will just give two quick examples. One is Social Security. We think of Social Security as affecting everyone. But when the law was passed in the 1930s, there were two occupations that were excluded, domestic workers and agricultural workers. And those were the two occupations that were held by African-Americans and Latinos. 85% of the women in the South that were African-American were domestic workers. They didn't have access to Social Security. Now, if your parents had Social Security, then they were taken care of, and you didn't have to use your own income to take care of them. So obviously, the assets have an effect over generations. So advantage accumulates over time, as does disadvantage. So what we're seeing today in terms of the disparity is the accumulation of advantage and disadvantage. One of our allies, Tom Shapiro, who was a co-author of the book Black Wealth, White Wealth, says inheritance is the main way that race and class privilege is passed along. And today, one out of every four white people will inherit from their families. And I don't mean massive amounts of money. I just mean, you know, relatively small amounts, too. But only one in 20 African Americans will inherit from their parents. And for every dollar inherited by a white person, an African American will only have 8 cents. So this is how these disparities continue to get passed along. I guess what do we do about this, or why does this even matter? I think that for many white families, the argument is that I don't want to give anything up. You know, we did work hard, and I think we're not contesting that. Every group did work hard, and that is certainly one element of the success story. But it is wrong to say that some groups worked harder than others. Everybody worked really hard. In fact, if hard work was the main reason for wealth, the African Americans would have been the wealthiest people in the country, and they would be the wealthiest people today. So that kind of certainly puts the lie to that story. But at the points that the United States government did invest heavily in building wealth and assets at the base, it really benefited the whole economy. So take the GI Bill as an example. It was a massive tax-funded program where GIs were able to go to college for free. If you could get into Harvard, it was totally paid for 4 years. And subsidized home mortgage as well to help you buy your first home. The problem with the GI Bill, once again, is it didn't address discrimination in the universities, in the housing markets, so that even though it was eligible to people of color, they did not get the same benefit. So it basically built a huge white middle class. But still, it's a good thing when our government invests in people to lift them up and to create a middle class. I think our point is that we need to do it again, but we need to include those who were left out of past wealth-building policies. So I just wanted to mention a couple of ideas that are floating around out there. There are some individual ideas. There's something called independent development accounts. Maybe some of you have heard of them. But if a low-income family puts aside a certain amount in savings, this gets back to the idea of the necessity of savings, it will be matched by either a private source or the government. And a number of states have pools of money for this purpose. Unfortunately, it's kind of small, and often people will get wiped out by some emergency. But It's still one idea. There's also something called the Aspire Act that has been introduced in Congress a couple of times, and it's based on a program that was already passed in England called the Baby Bonds Program. The idea is that every single baby gets a $500 bond from the government at birth, and that bond will grow over time, and you can add to it tax-free, and in fact the government will add to it for low asset people up to the age of 5, and hopefully by the time the child is 18 there will be a bit of a pot of money for them to draw on for tuition and so on. But the main one is that we really have to get back to taxing wealth in order to pay for some of these programs. And United for a Fair Economy has been fighting to stop the repeal of the estate tax, and we actually just won that a couple of weeks ago. But the estate tax is only paid by the top 0.27% of families in the United States, and yet there were these 18 wealthy families that have funded a campaign to get rid of the estate tax, saving themselves billions of dollars if they didn't have to pay it. But Bill Gates Sr. was our spokesperson on this matter, and he said that, in fact, wealthy people have benefited most from what this country has to offer, therefore they owe back to the public treasury. So, for example, Bill Gates Jr., if he had been born in a country that didn't have our educational system, if our government hadn't invested as it did with tax dollars in research that produced the computer and the internet, all of that stuff Bill was able to take advantage of. If he had been born somewhere else, he could have been just as smart, worked just as hard, but be poor as dirt. So I think that, you know, we still have to, tax is a mechanism for creating opportunities for those that don't have any. We say in this country that we value work, that work is sort of the basic thing that we respect. And yet right now, we tax income from working at a higher rate than taxing income from owning. So we've cut the dividend tax, we've cut the, you know, interest on stocks and bonds, and actually that just got extended, but I think people need to learn more about it and to roll that back, so that working people sometimes really do need some tax relief, but they're not getting it, while people who already have a lot have, you know, are just getting more. So I think that our message really is that we need to fund the dream. When Martin Luther King gave his speech in 1963, his I Have a Dream speech, it's called his I Have a Dream speech, but it really wasn't his intention to lay out a dream. What he said in that speech is that I come to the Capitol with a promissory note. We have been promised right life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and we're here to cash it in. And he also said that there's nothing new about poverty and inequality in this country. What is new is that we have the resources and the technology to eliminate it, but what we lack is the will. So I think that what we're hoping is, as more information comes to light, that we will build up our national will to address the problem of economic and racial inequality.
You've been listening to Meju Louis, co-author of The Color of Wealth, speaking about the history and impact today of the racial wealth divide. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Dan Turner, Ronald Rucker, Alexis McCrimmon, and to Yasuyo Nagata. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For a CD copy of program number 4006, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. Or go to radioproject.org. Lisa Redman is our Executive Director, Dorian Taylor Communications Manager, and I'm your host and Senior Producer, Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.